I would like to remind you that this is the morning of the inquirer's class for anyone present who would like to know more about this church. We meet in a room at the end of the corridor to the west immediately after this service is over. The question this morning is whether a sermon, to be a legitimate sermon, has to begin with a verse from the Bible and speak the name of Jesus 36 times before it comes to an end. If it does, Shakespeare was wrong to talk about finding sermons in stones, and our own congregational ancestors in New England were wrong to speak so beautifully of how truth is forever breaking in upon us from new and unlikely places. They had noticed that Jesus might create a sermon from almost anything. If a tower under construction fell and killed the workmen, if soldiers massacred some worshipers while they were on their knees at prayer, he took those happenings as texts and made them serve the truth he wanted to preach. If wildflowers blossomed in a meadow under his feet, he took their innocent and trusting spontaneity as a text and turned them into part of the gospel. So if I feel sure of anything, it's that he would take up one of our novels, or a movie, or a play, as a text, or speak of some happening in the street and make it light up the way to God, just as he did once with a lost coin, a mustard seed, a house built foolishly on the sand, a reckless boy who broke his father's heart. I believe that if he were in this pulpit, one of his sermons might very well be drawn from a popular play that says things about home life and tolerance, about love and forgiveness that he said himself over and over in the language of his time. It would make a marvelous sermon if we produced the play in this very room. But I had to settle for a simpler way and walk you quickly through the scenes that light up what the Bible has in mind when it speaks of God as love. You can use your imagination to see the characters, just as people who see the play itself have to imagine houses and a main street and a church and a cemetery because they are not literally represented on stage. The audience is guided by a folksy New England Yankee stage manager to see what is not in front of them. Grover's Corners, a small town in New Hampshire. Most of you know by now, of course, that we're about to recreate some parts of a play entitled Our Town, written a little over 50 years ago by Thornton Wilder. I invite each one of you to engage your imagination and see a sermon. You'll like the first thing the stage manager tells you as the play begins. It's morning, he says, and right over there is the Congregational Church. The milkman comes by with his horse, Bessie, who is going on 17, and is mixed up about the deliveries since one family stopped taking their daily quart of milk. She wants to leave it. just the same. And so she scolds the driver all the rest of the way. I may relate to that a little more intimately than the rest of you, because once upon a time, long ago, for a few days one summer, I had a job driving a horse-drawn milk wagon in Oklahoma City. Actually, I didn't do the driving. The horse, whose name was Cliff, knew the route by heart, and he decided when to cross the busy streets and which houses to stop at. And like Bessie in our play, he stamped his foot impatiently when I tried to take charge. So the play has captured me already in the way literature can do when it touches some of your own experience. But digression is a mark of dotage, I understand. So back to the play. We get introduced to Dr. and Mrs. Gibbs and their children, to George, who can't think of anything but sports, and his sister Becky, who is fussing about what dress to wear, and who says that she always goes off to school dressed like a sick turkey. We meet Mr. and Mrs. Webb and their children, who aren't eating breakfast quite the way Mrs. Webb would like. Put your book away, Wally. I'd rather have my kids healthy than bright. Emily chirps up that she's already the brightest girl in school for her age. Her busy mother distractedly says to them, "Stand up straight, children. Don't run. Do you have your coat?" And off they go to school. That evening, Mrs. Gibbs and Mrs. Webb go to choir practice at their congregational church, where the director pleads for a little softness. "Get it out of your heads," he tells them, "that music's only good when it's loud. You leave loudness to the Methodists. You couldn't beat them even if you wanted to." This Yankee choir director is named Simon Stimson, and he bears a burden we'll hear a little more about later. There's a brief sermon in the play on how to handle a son. Dr. Gibbs says to son George, "While I was in the office today, I heard a funny sound. And what do you think it was? It was your mother chopping wood. You see your mother over there getting up early, cooking meals all day, washing and ironing. And still, she has to go out in the backyard and chop wood. I suppose she just got tired of asking you and decided it was easier to do it herself. And you eat her meals and put on the clothes she keeps nice for you. And you run off and play baseball like she's some hired girl we keep around the house but that we don't like very much. Well, I knew all I had to do was call your attention to it. George, I've decided to raise your spending money 25 cents a week. Not, of course, for chopping wood for your mother, because that's a present you give her, but because you're getting older, and I imagine there are lots of things you must find to do with it." And there's a quick sermon on tolerance and forgiveness. Because unlike our own Bob Scott, Simon, the choir director, scandalizes the congregational church at times because he drinks too much. Some think he ought to be fired. But Mrs. Webb says, it's getting better. And besides, we all know about the troubles he's been through. And after all, Dr. Ferguson keeps him on at the church. And Dr. Ferguson knows all about the drinking. And so we must try not to notice. Act 2 is 3 years later. Some of the kids have fallen in love. Some of the older folk have found their hearts are pounding a bit when they go up the stairs. And it's their wedding day for George Gibbs and Emily Webb. Dr. Gibbs frets about it a little to his wife. And I'm sure there must be fathers here who will relate well to what he says. I had a long talk with the boy today. I tell you, there's nothing so terrifying in the world as a son. The relation of a father to a son is the damnedest, awkwardest. I always come away feeling like a soggy sponge of hypocrisy. The bride's mother says, as she goes in to church, I don't know why on earth I should be crying. It just came over me at breakfast this morning. There was Emily eating her breakfast as she's done for 17 years. And now she's going off to eat it in someone else's house. I suppose that's it. Simple, homespun, ordinary moments. I leave out lots of things because they don't make a sermon. And the last act, Act 3, is 9 years later. And we're at the edge of a quiet, lovely graveyard, overlooking the lake and the hills. Mr. Stimson, our old organist and choir director, is there now, his vexed and difficult days on earth over. And Emily Webb's brother, Wally, is there because his appendix ruptured when there was no help near. And Mrs. Gibbs, her mother-in-law, is there, and others, and they all seem to be waiting for something important while the earth part of them burns away. There's a new funeral happening on this very day, and while the undertaker waits for it to start, he looks at old Simon Stimson's epitaph, a bit puzzled. It's a few bars of some melody. He says, these musical fellas ain't like the rest of us, I reckon. Took his own life. Hung himself in the attic. It's Emily Webb's funeral that day. Emily has died in childbirth, and the living around her grave are singing, Blessed Be the Tie That Binds, a song we've all sung many times. Like the rest of the dead, Emily is puzzled by how little the living seem to understand. They're sort of shut up in little boxes, aren't they? She says. And then she realizes that she can go back for a visit. But all the dead tell her sternly not to do this. It's not what you think it would be. The stage manager warns her, you not only live it, you watch yourself living it. And as you watch, you see the things that they down there never know. You see the future. You know what's going to happen afterwards. But Emily says, I'll choose a happy day. The happiest day of my life, the day I first knew that I loved George. George's mother says, no. No, choose at least an ordinary, unimportant day. The least important day in your life will be important enough. Emily settles on her 12th birthday, and suddenly she's back on earth among her family on that day of her life with the sun coming up after a snowstorm. Her dad has been out of town on business. Her mother comes into the room to call the children, time to get up. Emily says, Mama, here I am. Oh, how young Mama looks. I didn't know Mama was ever that young. Emily sees herself as a child again, a child who can't find her blue hair ribbon. Her mother says, with a poignant irony, we mustn't miss. Just open your eyes, dear. Poignant because that's what this whole play sermon is about, opening our eyes. Emily says softly now, more in wonder than in grief, I can't bear it. They're so young and beautiful. Why did they ever have to get old? Mama, I'm here. I'm grown up. I love you all. I love everything. I can't look at everything hard enough. Her mother kisses her good morning, as always, rather matter-of-factly. After all, she doesn't know the future. She rattles on the way every mother in the world rattles on when it's just another day. Chew your bacon. Eat your breakfast, good and slow. Emily, still softly but very urgently now, begins to talk. Oh, Mama, just look at me 1 minute as though you really saw me. Mama, 14 years have gone by. I'm dead. You're a grandmother. I married George Gibbs, Mama. Wally's dead too, Mama. His appendix burst on a camping trip to North Conway. We just felt terrible about it. Don't you remember? But just for a moment now, we're all together. Mama, just for a moment, we're happy. Let's look at one another. Her mother, of course, goes on as always. She says, your father has a surprise. Don't know what it is myself. And as her returning father comes in calling for her, Emily says in a loud voice to the stage manager, I can't. I can't go on. I had no idea it all goes so fast. We don't have time to look at one another. I didn't realize. So all that was going on, and we never noticed. She begs the stage manager now to be taken back. But she begs him to wait a minute for one last look, her true goodbye this time to the world, to Grover's Corners. And then she says in the play's supreme moment, goodbye. Goodbye to clocks ticking and Mama's sunflowers and food and coffee and new ironed dresses and hot baths and sleeping and waking up. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. She looks at the stage manager and asks through her tears, Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it? Every minute? He says, no. But after a pause, he says, the saints and poets, maybe, they do some. She and the stage manager return to the tranquil graveyard. And Emily confesses to grouchy old Mr. Stimson that she should have listened to their advice. Yes, he says, now you know. Now you know that's what it was to be alive, to move about in a cloud of ignorance, to go up and down trampling on the feelings of those about you, to spend and waste time as though you had a million years, to be always at the mercy of one self-centered passion or another. Now you know. I'm glad old Simon has what is almost the last word. This sensitive and troubled soul who drank too much to hide from what he knew about life, who left the world on his own time schedule because the pain was too much. But it isn't quite the last word, because Wilder believes too much in the glory and wonder of life to leave it there. And so he has Mrs. Gibbs say, Simon Stimson, that ain't the whole truth, and you know it. So what is the truth? The truth is that just for a moment now, we're all together. Let's look at one another. The most ordinary day of our lives is wonderful beyond our knowing, unless we live in a cloud of ignorance, forever distracted, no time to notice.